As Tom said, our reading is from Luke chapter 18, starting at verse 9. This is on page 877 of the Church Bibles. Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted.
Thanks very much, Kara, for reading, and really great to have you all with us this morning. My name's Mikey, if we've not met before. Well, imagine that God said to you, why should I let you into heaven? What would you say, I wonder? I'm a decent person. I go to church. I've never really done anything that bad. I've lived a pretty good life. Many people would answer along those lines to that question because we live in a world where we're just used to having to work for the reward. You go through school and university and you have to work, don't you, to do well in exams, to build that CV, to be offered the job you want. You have to work to pass probation, to be retained. You have to work harder if you want a promotion and if you want a decent pension. Well, again, in the words of Rihanna, me happy work. Work, 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 work. That just seems to be how it goes in this world. You have to work for the reward. To get something, you need to earn it. Well, we pick up Luke's gospel today, where Jesus has been talking about what makes us ready for his final return. One day, Jesus has promised to come back. What will make us ready? Just before our passage, Jesus singled out faith as the thing that we need to be ready for his heavenly kingdom on that final day. Just glance to the end of verse 8, just before our passage, if you would. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? But in our world, where you just have to always work for anything, for the reward, this idea of faith alone just doesn't sit easily for us. We think that if Jesus came back today, isn't it the list of things that I've done that will really make a difference if I'm going to be led into heaven? And certainly the Bible does talk about the importance of the way that we live. And so it can be confusing. Are our works maybe part of what makes us right with God? I've heard people who would call themselves Christians say to me, well, yeah, of course we need faith, but the key is living a good life for God to be pleased with us. Some suggest that we need to meet certain external markers to be a real Christian. We have to be giving a certain amount of money to church or serving in certain ways or go to confession maybe or to be confirmed or go on some pilgrimage even or be committed to social causes. But what that does is to imply that faith isn't enough. That is saying that we need to add things on top of faith in order to get us right with God, to make sure that we're really ready for heaven. And so I think that Luke's aim in this parable is to make us certain that faith really is enough, that faith alone is all we need to be right with God. But to show us that, Jesus first exposes the danger of trying it the other way, of relying on ourselves, on our own works. And so you'll see the first point on the back of your sheets. God rejects all who trust in themselves. Looking at verse 9, we see that Jesus is talking to some who trusted in themselves, that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. And so Jesus makes up this parable about someone who is exactly like the people that he's speaking to. Very pointed. Have a look down at verse 11, where the scene is set in the temple. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. I've tried to break this guy's attitude down on the sheet there. First, you see, it's a classic case of the comparison game. This Pharisee thinks, compared to others, I'm good. He starts, God, I thank you that I am not like other men. Today you hear people say, well, I'm not a murderer, I'm not a rapist or anything like that. And in just the same way, this guy makes a mental list of various bad people and he strikes them all off. Extortioners, unjust, adulterers. I'm certainly better than all of them. And at the end of verse 11, he feels the need to compare himself in particular with one individual that he has noticed in the temple to prove his point. Or even like this tax collector. You probably know tax collectors were widely hated in society at the time. Think a pantomime villain who people would hiss and boo at. Traitors to Israel who had sold out to work for the Roman enemy. And they often took advantage of their position to demand more tax than was required to make themselves rich. So this tax collector, he is an obvious target for the Pharisee to play the comparison game with. Look at him, God. I'm so much better than that guy. And as smug as he is, this Pharisee has got a point, especially when he lines up his own credentials. Have a look at verse 12. He says, I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get. The Old Testament law at the time required people to fast once a year. This guy does it twice a week. And similarly, the law only required crops to be tithed, that is, to give 10%. But this guy tithed everything. You can imagine him getting an M&S delivery and carefully measuring out 10% of all of his herbs, all of his Percy Pigs, his Colin the Caterpillar cake, even 10% of his loo roll. His rule-keeping goes above and beyond. His whole life is shaped around it. His CV of religious works is seriously impressive, and he knows it. And so he says, compared to others, I'm good. But the second step, which follows on from that first one, is that he thinks, well, then I can depend on myself. I think the footnote in verse 11 is very revealing. Do you see that there? At the bottom of the page, the footnote that links to verse 11, when it says the Pharisee standing by himself prayed, it could equally mean the Pharisee standing prayed to himself. And I think that seems to sum up exactly what is going on here, because this is hardly a prayer to God. After this guy's first four words, he's forgotten all about God, and it is all about him. Five times he uses the word I. I'm better than them. I do this, I do that. He's using prayer time in the temple just as a chance to massage his own ego. He's basically just telling God what an amazing bloke he is. He's not asking God for help for anything. He assumes that there's nothing more that he needs. Look at everything that I do, God. I'm all sorted. He assumes that he's got some sort of contract, I guess, with God, where his good deeds have earned him, he's worked to get this unconditional offer into heaven. He thinks that he's earned the right to be right with God. He's depending on himself. But Jesus wants us to be clear that this is not the Christian way. He tells this parable to expose how ugly it is to depend on our own deeds. It displays such an arrogance. And this character is meant to help put us off trusting in ourselves, in our own works. And all the more so where we see where that path ends up. Jesus turns from this Pharisee to next address the tax collector. But the big shock of Jesus' story is the punchline in verse 14, if you have a look down there. I tell you that this man, the tax collector, went down to his justified rather than the other, the Pharisee. Well, you can imagine the shock on the faces of those Jesus is telling this story to. They would have assumed that this Pharisee would have strolled into heaven because of his moral CV. But he is not the one who is declared righteous, who is declared justified. That means right with God. He went away not justified, not right with God, rejected by God. And the point is that if even this Pharisee, with his such impressive moral CV, is rejected, then it will be the same for anyone else who tries to depend on their works. God rejects all who trust in themselves. I remember having a couple of Elisa's uni friends over for dinner one time, and although they'd heard the gospel before, they were still confused when we managed to get the conversation onto this topic. They tried to go through the Ten Commandments, sort of list off as many as they could remember. They were saying, well, we haven't killed anyone. I'm not married, so I haven't committed adultery. I think they were kind of struggling to remember any more of the ten after that. But their general gist was, I'm a good person. I've lived a pretty decent life. I'll be fine if there is a God. But Jesus says that's just not true. As verse 14 continues, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. The sobering truth is that anyone who tries to depend on their own deeds to exalt themselves before God will be humbled on the day Jesus returns. What a dreadful thought to reach that final day expecting to be all good with God and to realize that they're not. To stand before Jesus and to be humbled, to be brought low for eternity. So come back to those moments when we're tempted to think, well, isn't it the list of things that I've done that matters most to God? Well, can we see how dangerous that thinking is? We need to snap ourselves out of that worldly, worksy thinking and not listen to anyone who encourages it, because God rejects those who trust in themselves. Instead, we should try and warn anyone else who may have been taken in by that kind of deadly self-reliance. I mean, glance back to verse 9. Why is Jesus telling this parable in the first place to people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous? Surely it is to try and show them where they've gone wrong. Jesus doesn't get a kick out of telling people off. He wants to give them a wake-up call so that they realize the danger that they're in. And doesn't this simile spur us on to pray and to look for opportunities to do the same with others? I mean, how many of our friends or colleagues or people that we rub shoulders with day to day still have this false assurance that they will just sail into heaven when they die? What a tragedy if they have a false assurance and it stays that way. That's why at that dinner we just had to say to those friends, don't you know that you can never be good enough for God? People need to see that trying to justify ourselves is deadly, because God rejects all who trust in themselves. Well, it is a sobering truth, isn't it? But it helps us to treasure the good news of our second point all the more. God accepts all who trust in mercy. God accepts all who trust in mercy. As we return to our parable, the camera pans from this Pharisee standing proud and tall to a totally contrasting figure. Have a look down at verse 13, if you would. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but he beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Well, everything about this tax collector's body language says, compared to God, I am sinful. He knows he's in the temple, the place where God's holy presence symbolically dwelt, and he is just so aware of the huge moral chasm between himself and God's perfect holiness. That's why this guy is standing so far off. He feels totally unworthy to stand before a holy God. What a contrast to the Pharisee's blasé attitude. This tax collector won't even lift up his eyes. You can imagine him sort of tucked away right at the back somewhere, hanging his head low, hunched over, sort of crumpled in on himself, probably, as though he's trying to sort of hide among the paving stones of the floor. He feels that even lifting up his eyes would just expose all of his wrongdoing before God in heaven. He's comparing himself to God's holy perfection, and that forces him to admit that he's a sinner, verse 13. And it is literally the sinner. To me, the sinner. It's as though there's no one else in the temple. He's got no one else in view, just him and God. See, he could have, I guess, tried to compare himself with worse sinners, with other people. Well, I'm not a murderer, God. At least I'm better than some people. But he knows that there's no point playing that worldly comparison game to try and justify himself. He's actually making a very different comparison, the only right one, the comparison between him and God. And he's realized that before God, we can't cover up the bad things that we've done. We can't bargain them away with our good deeds or try to sort of counterbalance our sin before such a holy God. And so all he is left to do, well, he just simply beats his breast with deep sorrow, deep regret, deep sense of his total unworthiness before God. Well, this trip to the temple doesn't exactly seem like a positive experience for this tax collector, doesn't it? I mean, I'm sure a day out with his friends would have been much more enjoyable for him. But he's come to God because he knows he must. He needs to make just one simple request. Have another look at the end of verse 13. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Whereas the Pharisee thought, I can depend on myself, this tax collector knows I must depend on mercy, on God's mercy. What is mercy? As we've been thinking this morning, it's being spared the punishment that we deserve. His cry for God to be merciful actually has the sense of deal with my sin. That is the particular thing in mind. That is why he's come to the temple, because the temple is where sacrifices were made to deal with sin. He knows that that is what he desperately needs. He knows that he is a sinner, someone who is not in the right before God. And so he simply throws himself on the mercy of God. He doesn't try to justify himself or point to his own works. This is faith alone. And look again at Jesus' verdict in verse 14. I tell you that this man went down to his house justified. This tax collector, this traitor went home that day right with God, accepted the very moment that he simply asked for mercy. Well, this would have sounded just completely outrageous to those listening to Jesus' story. This immoral traitor being accepted by God. And similarly, I think it would raise eyebrows today. It could be a great conversation starter with any non-Christians we happen to chat to this week. Maybe we ask about their weekend, we get the return question, and we could say, oh, well, I went to church and we heard this incredible story about a story that Jesus tells. This super moral guy is rejected by God, whereas this really bad guy he is the one accepted by God. It's very provocative, isn't it, for those who think that we need to earn everything we get, to work for it. But for the Christian, depending on faith alone, this story gives us wonderful assurance. Because if God accepts even this tax collector, well, then we know that he will accept anyone who simply asks for mercy. Of course, for us to ask mercy today, we don't need to go to any temple or even a church to have sacrifices for our sin, because Jesus himself is our sacrifice. As Jesus tells this parable, he is approaching Jerusalem, where he knows that he will die on a cross. And as he hung there on that cross, Jesus dealt with sin. He faced the punishment that we deserve in our place so that we can be fully accepted by God. And so, if we ever have those doubts, well, is our faith really enough to make us right with God? Well, tell yourself, yes. Yes, it is. Because it is not about what we do. It is about what Jesus has already done. Not about what we do. It's about what God has already done. I mean, remember that tax collector? He had no works of his own to bring to the table. And yet he went home justified. There's an old hymn that sums it up well. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to the cross I cling. If you're here today trusting Jesus' death on the cross, well, no matter what you've done in the past, maybe, you can have full assurance that you're right with God today. It doesn't mean that we can use God's mercy just as an excuse to keep on sinning, doing whatever we like. Elsewhere, Jesus is very clear that trusting him does mean turning away from things that dishonor him. But what we do, it always comes after we believe, after we're saved. And it still actually doesn't even contribute to our being right with God. The point here is that Jesus has done everything necessary for us to be right with God. He does all the work. And if we depend fully on him, we can be certain that God is willing to accept us because of his great mercy, right now in the present and also in the future. I mean, have a final look at the end of verse 14 again. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted. Christians have a glorious, exalted future to look forward to in heaven. And it is certain for all who have humbled themselves now to depend on God's mercy. I once heard the story of a criminal on death row called Jim Johnson. He pled guilty to murdering several people. But in his final statement before he was executed, it seems that he had genuinely turned to Jesus. After apologizing again to his victims' families, he said this: "The news reports today will say that Jim Johnson is dead. Those reports will be untrue. Today, I will meet the one who gave his life for my sins, the one who extended to me mercy. Today, I shall meet Jesus, my Lord and Savior, face to face. When the executioners have done their worst, God will be shown to have done his best." Well, that will sound still very outrageous to many people. But to the Christian, it is the precious truth of mercy. Because when we stop comparing ourselves to one another and instead compare ourselves only to God, then we will realize that we all fall short. We are no more deserving than a murderer like Jim Johnson. God's mercy is the only hope for all of us. And as we close, a good test as to whether we've really understood this is to come back to that question that we opened with. If God were to say to us today, "Why should I let you into heaven?" what would you say? Because you've lived a decent life? Because you've been to church a bit? Well, no. The true Christian would say, well, God, you shouldn't let me into heaven because of anything that I've done, but simply because I'm trusting in your mercy through Jesus. It's a brilliant question to try and ask our friends and colleagues as well, perhaps. Or it may be that there are just a few here today who have never made that decision to trust fully in God's mercy. Or maybe you're thinking that you can kind of depend partly on your works and partly on faith. Well, Jesus would urge you to copy the tax collector, to join every Christian in admitting that you're a sinner, that you're in the wrong before God. There's nothing you can do, and simply throw yourself on the mercy of God. Very humbling to acknowledge that we can't even contribute to our standing before God. But it is the only way to heaven. Jesus promises the one who humbles himself will be exalted. And those who have done this will be able to tell you how liberating this is. We don't have to carry around with us any doubts of, have I done enough? The answer is no, but we don't need to, because Jesus has done everything for us to make us right with God. What a relief that it's not about what we do, but about what he has already done. Let's close in a prayer. Father God, thank you so much that at the cross, Jesus has already done everything to open the way to us for heaven. Please would you steer us away from the danger of any thoughts that we might need to depend on our own works. And rather, please help us to trust in your mercy alone, certain that that is the only way to be right with you. Amen.